Grover's funeral. I wasn't at the actual funeral. I went Friday up for the visitation, and the lineup of people to just give their condolences was right out the door at one point. So it was quite, I guess, an encouraging remembrance. Some of you know of Grover. Grover really launched Partners International here in Canada, and a number of years ago, he got me involved as a pastor, and I traveled with him and opened my eyes to a whole new world of ministry, and just as the blessing that came through his ministry. And then I worked at Partners for a couple of years and was able to really be enriched during that time as I got to know a number of the nationals overseas, some tremendous workers in various countries. And Grover will be truly missed. He was unique in so many ways when it came to the mission world. I'm just going to move a few things here before I wave my arms and knock something over. Do you believe it's almost the end of August? I mean, that's crazy, isn't it, eh? But it has been a good summer, hasn't it? I mean, we had a terrible spring, but then the light sort of came on in the end of June, and we've had a wonderful summer and continue to enjoy beautiful weather. And I hear, good news, I hear the fall is going to be exceptionally warm and sunny right through the end of October. So that's good to look forward to. And it seems that all your elders took advantage of one of the last weeks in August to get away, or most of them, from what I understand. So, and that's good too. Some of you have had a chance to get away over the summer, and perhaps others not, but it is often a chance to just recharge our battery, isn't it? And we're a little more low-key in our services and our worship time, and I've enjoyed being with you for the 3 weeks that I have. And I was just down the road last week, too, down at Parkway. So just kind of back and forth here over the summer, and it's been a real pleasure to be with you. I want to test your memory a little bit this morning as we begin. You remember the phrase that I taught you, I guess it would be 4 weeks ago now in our first time together. Remember what it was? I am an alien. That's right, I'm an alien. We looked at the life of Abraham and how he held on to things loosely when asked by God to go to a land that he didn't know anything about or where he was going. He packed everything up and off he went. And if we're going to have the kind of faith to get us through life, faith that every day brings us one step closer to God, as it were, then it has to be this kind of faith that hangs on to things loosely, that recognizes we're just aliens in this land, in this world, passing through, and that we ought to be paying attention more closely to God than the things around us. And then there was the phrase that I taught you the following week. Anybody remember it? Do not be afraid. And then you stuck your own name in there. Do not be afraid, David. God had come to Abram and he said, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. And he said, don't be afraid because I am your very great reward, your shield and your very great reward. And we looked at the whole idea of God being our shield, that we do not have to fear the things of this world, that our faith in God is enough. Faith in him alone, not in the outcome. That's the mistake we often make. We look for the outcome and we say to ourselves, well, I don't see it happening. I don't have enough faith. No, it's faith in God, and that is enough, that he is a God who is able to do all that he plans to do, all that he wills to do. Well, this week, our phrase comes naturally when we have to face something on our journey that is seemingly impossible. Impossible because it's one of those things that we hold so dear, we couldn't imagine God asking us to let go of it. You remember 2 weeks ago, I asked you to make a little list of the top three things that you struggled to let go of. I want you to go to the top of that list for a moment, the one that was right at the very top. And now I want you to imagine God saying to you, let go of that. I want that. Give it to me. It's hard, isn't it? It's one of the very things that we hold dear. Maybe it's your children or your spouse. The one thing that God asks you to let go of, and you would cry out to him in that moment, anything but that, Lord. And that's our phrase this morning, anything but that. Because you see, as sobering as that thought is, it's the one thing we could not bear to lose. And even as we think about this, I know that there are some of you here this morning have been in that place. or maybe you're even in that place now, who know the pain of losing that one thing, a child, a spouse, that friend. And you know what it's like to cry out to God in desperation, anything but that. Anything but that, Lord. And I ask you, as we begin this morning, as we look at this final chapter of Abram's life, I want you to be thinking about that thing at the top of your list, that person. I don't want to cause you unnecessary pain, but I want to help you understand what it must have been like for Abraham as he walked down that road so many years ago, how hard it must have been for him in that circumstance. Too often, critics of the Bible accuse it of being out of touch with where we are today. Well, the truth is, we've all walked down that road that Abraham walked, that road on that one scholar called the road of God-forsakenness, where it seems when we cry out, we don't hear from God. He's not listening somehow. As a pastor, I have sat with people who have anguished over not hearing from God, who have said, I have cried out to God to help me in this, to deal with this, to help me get through this, and I haven't heard from him. And it seems like it's dark. It's a dark road, because Abraham wasn't just losing Isaac. He was going to destroy him, and at the command of God, the one who had promised to make him a blessing to the world, the very one who had said, I will give you a son and I will give you heirs, and now God had called him to destroy that. So what do you do when you have to walk in the darkness, when God seems so distant or remote or even silent? Our story today is about that dark road. And some of you here this morning, I know, are walking that road even now. You know the pain and the heartache of not hearing from God. There is something you need to know, we all need to know about faith, that sometimes faith means you just keep going. So often we think of people in the church who are pillars of faith. And we say, what is it about them? But if you sat down with them, if you listen to their story, so often in life, when it gets its darkest, they will say to you, I just kept going. I just kept trusting. And that's the way it is with faith sometimes. Sometimes you have to just keep going. You just keep walking in darkness and you refuse to quit. You just hang on, because that's what faith is about. It's about hanging on in those dark places. It's important to understand that this is not about doubt-free faith, but about hanging on. It's about a tenacious obedience when the road is so dark you can't even see the ground under your feet. When I was younger and we lived in Calgary, I was a skier, and we used to go up. It was a close enough drive. You could go up for the day to the Rocky Mountains there in Banff and ski. And I can remember on one particular occasion skiing at the very top of the mountain. And what would happen often is a cloud would come over the mountain, and it would descend, in a sense, right on that mountaintop where you were skiing, and the snow was white and the cloud was white, and it was absolutely disorientating. You didn't know what was up and what was down. It was so white, you could say so dark in some respects, that you didn't know which way was up and down. The only way you could tell was to reach out and touch the ground with your pole, and if it was up, you knew that this was down. Too often or not, you reach this way first and you went boom. That's how it is to walk in that darkness sometimes. Like I said, this is the last chapter in Abraham's life. It is the climax of the story. So I want to invite you, if you have your Bible or your phone or whatever you use, turn to chapter 22 of Genesis. Chapter 22. Now, up to this point, we've been walking with Abraham through Genesis 12, as God made a wonderful promise to him, through his faltering in Egypt, through his stumbling with Hagar, and to that day that God gave him a son. But as amazing as all that has been, it all leads to this chapter where we want to pick up our story today. Now, when I was with you before, I mentioned to you that the value or the purpose of the Old Testament is both to show us how to relate to God as he related to human beings like Abraham, but it also gives us a glimpse of God's promise in Jesus Christ. And this is one of those chapters that I want you to mark. You can just put the word Christ beside it, because the whole chapter, as it unfolds, gives us a glimpse of the coming of the Son and what he will do for us. So keep that in mind as we go through this. Now, I want to pick the story up here today. And I want to, back in chapter 21, we have the story of the birth of Isaac, how exciting that was, and all that took place there. And then we go to chapter 22, and it says this in verse 1. Sometime later, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. Abraham replied, Here I am. Then God said, Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. Early the next morning, Abraham got up, saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. And when they had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for a place God had told him about. And on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. And he said to his servants, Stay here with the donkey while I will go with the boy, go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood and the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac. And he himself carried the fire and the knife. And as the two went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father again, Father! Yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went together. And when they reached the place that God had told them about, Abraham built an altar there, and he arranged the wood on it, and he bound his son Isaac, and he laid him on the altar on the top of the wood. And then he reached out with his hand and took his knife to slay his son. You have the picture? There they are on the top of the mountain. The altar's been built. That is an assembly of a group of stones. He's put the wood on the altar, and now his son is tied there. Imagine what he must have been feeling in this moment. But he takes that knife and he holds it in the air over his son, ready to plunge it in and sacrifice his son. And then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham! Here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. And he went over, and he took the ram, and he sacrificed it as it had been a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, The Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through their offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. Then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba. It's the climax of the story. And it's important to understand something. Go back to verse number 1 first. It's important, don't miss this. It says, sometime later, God tested Abraham. I say this is important because someone once came to me. I was doing a seminar, and they came to me. It was on the Old Testament, and they said to me, you know, the reason I'm not a Christian is Christians sacrifice their children. And she pointed to this story. We can't go there. Before we go there, we have to go back to verse 1 and see what it says. It says there, sometime later, God tested Abraham. You see, when God says this, that sometime later he tested Abraham, he's effectively telling us the outcome. By saying this, that he is going to be tested, God is effectively saying that Isaac's life was never really in danger. This is a test. Unfortunately, Abraham isn't privy to this information. So for him, the outcome is uncertain. Have you ever had one of those really difficult tests to face? I love the story of the young man studying zoology. He was studying for a test. It was on birds, and he really thought he had this test nailed. To his horror, when he got to class, all that was there were photos of different birds' feet on the wall. And the professor turned to the class, and he said, Your test is to identify these birds by their feet. And when the student went ballistic, He said to the professor, "This is ridiculous. Nobody studies birds' feet, for crying out loud. I didn't study birds' feet. I can't identify these birds." And the prophet said, "Well, I guess you fail." The young man replied, "That's not fair. I'm leaving." And the prof said, "You can't leave. I'll fail you." The young student said, "Well, okay, just watch me." And he got up and walked out. He was just about at the door, and that the professor yelled back to him, "All right, then, I'll fail you. What's your name?" With that, the young man whipped off his shoes and socks, lifted his pant legs up, and said, "You tell me." You see, the idea of being tested is an important concept in Scripture, especially in the book of Deuteronomy. It is the way that God sees what his people are made of. You can go through the book of Deuteronomy, you can see God testing his people over and over again for their willingness to be obedient. We do the same thing. We do it with our children. We put up boundaries around them and say, "Don't do this." And in a sense, it's a test. If they vary outside that boundary, then we bring them back with appropriate discipline. It's the way God sees what his people are made of. It's the way we find out. Athletes test themselves to see what they're made of. It's part of life. Tests are part of life. And this is the supreme test in the Old Testament, and it is a hard one. Now, if you're one of those folks who likes to have points for their message, can't really follow it unless you do, here's point number one. To kind of have the faith to see us through that road of God-forsakenness, it has to be a "here I am, Lord" faith. Here I am, Lord. That's the kind of faith that Abraham God has. God calls Abraham, and Abraham responds, "Here I am." Abraham's not saying this because he thinks that somehow God can't see him, that somehow he's missed him. No, he says, "Here I am as an offering. I'm yours. I'm at your disposal." Do you remember someone else who said, "Here I am"? Here I am, Moses. Remember, "I am, here I am, God." You see, we're at God's disposal. It's the same voice that he responded to when he was told to pack up everything and move to a strange land. The same voice that made a covenant with him, making him a partner in determining the future of humanity. It's the same voice that reaffirmed the promise of a son, even when he had messed up, when their combined ages were more than 190 years old. The same voice that had prompted him to laugh at the very prospect, but responded in obedience anyways. Now this voice comes to him once more. And in fact, as far as we know, this time is the last time God speaks to him through this experience. And he's going to ask him to give up one more thing, to give up the very thing, the promise itself, to give it all up, the wonderful promise. But now it seems as God is asking the impossible. He's asking him to give up what he lived so long to see fulfilled, the son. And so Abraham sets out on this God-forsaken road. He doesn't run and hide. He doesn't try to evade the issue or offer alternatives. He quite simply says, "I'm here. I'm at your disposal, God. I will hold nothing back from you." Isn't that a hard thing to say, isn't it? "I will hold nothing back from you." God doesn't just say to him, "Take Isaac." Notice what he says, "Take your son, your only son." Remember I said these words tend to point to Jesus? Words that must have pierced Abraham's heart. Words that would reach across the pages of time and find themselves repeated in the words of a fisherman. "For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son." Do you see the parallel? How is it possible that God could make such a request? Doesn't he know what he's asking? He's asking that the child he gave against all odds, the child whose announcement evoked, or whose arrival evoked laughter and disbelief, the child whose very name meant laughter, is now being handed over to die. It made no sense. But Abraham responded in obedience. And so verse 3 tells us, Abraham rose early the next morning and set out for a place that God had shown him. You know, the writer gives us few details here. He doesn't tell us what's going on in Abraham's mind or his heart, how a little piece of him must have been dying with every step of the journey, every step that he took, how the promise that seemed so real with the birth of Isaac just a chapter before was now fading with each step. how the stars that burned so brightly the night God took him outside and told him to count them seem to be going out now, one by one. Maybe you've walked on this road with Abraham. Maybe you haven't. But we can only begin to imagine what it must have been like as he headed down that road. Something we cannot forget ever. Abraham was real. He was a human being like you and me. He was a fallen human being like you and me. And so as he walked that road, that night, and that dark road, I can only imagine what he was feeling. Imagine for a moment you're a church planter. Now imagine you've worked 25 years with no results. Not one other person comes to the church. But you have this promise that God has made to you that he'll bless this work. And so you just keep going. You go to conferences. People ask, how many people go to your church? The answer you give doesn't get you invited to church planting conferences. And then one day, one person walks in. One person joins your little community. And you know that person represents the fulfillment of what God promised. You're ecstatic because your dreams have been fulfilled and they're all tied up in this one solitary person. And then a voice comes to you and says, take that one person out to the parking lot and run over them with your car. I know some pastors who have a list of people like that in the church they like to do that to. But no. See how hard it would be? Could you do it? Could you give up what you waited so long for, what the future depended on? Is God alone enough for you? Now go back to verse 4. It says, on the third day. Remember again, Jesus, third day. Keep that in mind. On the third day. Do you know what that means? That means that this agony that Abraham had to go through didn't last for a few moments, didn't last even for a few hours. It went on for 3 days, for three long days. Back about 15 years ago, I noticed a mole on my arm that turned color. So I went to see the doctor. And the doctor looked at it and immediately sent me to the specialist. And the specialist looked at it, and I was informed after the tests came back that I had stage 2 melanoma. And I knew melanoma was not a good thing. There's skin cancer and then there's melanoma. And I looked at, you know, the internet's a wonderful thing, but it can be too much information sometimes. And I looked up second stage or 2-stage melanoma, and then what the article essentially said was, get your affairs in order. Now, I had received this information, and I had been scheduled for surgery right away to remove the mole. And they didn't waste any time. But there was a period of about 3 days after I had had the surgery when I was waiting for the final results. Anybody else been there? Been down that cancer road? You know what it's like, isn't it? That dark road of 3 days of not knowing. Of just putting one foot in front of the other. And I can remember when it was all worked out and they got it all and everything else, obviously. But I can remember the specialist saying to me, well, what did you learn? I said, you know, without hesitation, God is real. God is real. Just that dark road as we walked, but I still knew God's presence. I still knew God was there. And even though Abraham walked down this road, so dark, 3 days, he trudged, he believed, he kept his faith. You see, we're able to see the end. And we want to say to Abraham, we want to cry out to him, it's all right, it turns out okay. He's not that kind of God. He will provide. But you know, life doesn't work that way, does it? Not for Abraham and not for us. We can only go one chapter at a time, one verse at a time, one day at a time. You can only start at the beginning and go to the middle. And when you're in the middle, no one gets to see what is ahead. No one gets to see what the end looks like. No one's allowed to see the final stage. You can only go by faith. You can only live in unreserved obedience by faith, by trusting him. Now, we need to say something about faith at this point before we go on with the story, because unfortunately, when we get down this far down the road of God-forsakenness, we often feel that our faith isn't good enough, that we don't have enough faith. We have a tendency to beat ourselves up about this point. This is often when people find themselves in the pastor's office saying, I just don't have enough faith. But see, we misunderstand what faith is. And we think we need more, or that we need to believe in God with more certainty, or that we can't have any doubts. Now, by nature, I'm a bit of a skeptic. I have serious doubts about the existence of Bigfoot, even though there was another article in the paper this morning. I have serious doubts about the Loch Ness Monster. I was in Scotland this last June, drove down beside Loch Ness, didn't see any monster, so I have my doubts. I have my doubts that Elvis is alive and working in some Taco Bell somewhere. And I don't believe the construction on the 401 will ever be completed. So you can see I'm a bit of a skeptic. Now, that's not altogether a bad thing, but neither is it necessarily a good thing, because it can hinder me in my spirituality. It can get in the way of my prayers. It can cause me to anguish when I see things that I can't explain, like pain and suffering. And it can make me wish I had answers when I don't, when in fact there are no answers. I can't tell you how many times as a pastor I sat with people through a tragedy and they say, why? Why? And I have to say to them, I don't know. I don't know. You see, sometimes we walk in darkness and are forced to step out even when we don't know where we're going. That's why it's also important to know that faith, the kind that pleases God, the kind that characterizes Abraham, is not primarily doubt-free. In fact, we've seen along the way, Abraham doubts God and keeps him from harm. It doubts God when he can fulfill the promise without his help. Yet all of these doubts, and he's still held up as one of the pillars of faith. Why? Because he just kept hanging on. He just kept obeying God. He just keeps walking down that road. It's interesting, at this point, he turns to the servants and he instructs them to wait. Well, he and Isaac go and sacrifice and worship. And then he adds, and we will come back to you. I wonder why he says this. Is he trying to mislead the servants, fearing they might try to intervene if they found out what was going to happen? Or maybe in his mind, does he think that he doesn't think he'll be able to go through with it? Perhaps he's hoping against hope that God will step in and yet fulfill the promise. It's a mystery, isn't it? We will come back. You know, he's not unlike the father who comes to Jesus one day in Mark chapter 9 and he says, please heal my son if you are able. And Jesus' response is, don't you know all things are possible with the one who believes? And then the classic response, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. You see, when we're on this dark road, that's where we are. It's not that we don't believe. It's just that that doubt, that unbelief creeps in and begins to undermine our faith. And so Abraham stays on the road, and he just keeps following God. Down in verse 6, you see the irony here. This is where, in verse 6, he says, Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son. He himself carried the fire and the knife. Here it is. His son is carrying the wood on which he will die. Does that ring any bells about our Savior carrying the cross, the wood upon which he will die? This is the irony. Jesus carried the cross, the wood upon which he would die. Now go to verse 8. This is the second point, if you're following. The kind of faith that we need on this God-forsaken road is a kind of faith that says God himself will provide, a belief that God will provide. And still they push on, just the two of them now. It would appear they walked in silence. After all, what is there to say? And then it suddenly dawns on Isaac, and he says to him, Father, Father, yes, my son. Father, we have the wood and the fire, but where is the sacrifice? And God answers almost half-heartedly, or rather, Abraham answers almost half-heartedly, God will provide. And then the writer says for the second time, the two of them walked together. I wonder in this moment, if this isn't the lowest point to which Abraham must have sank. And yet, he said the words, God will provide. His son says to him, I see the wood, I see the fire, but where's the sacrifice? And it must have just tore his heart apart at this point, because he knew what God had asked of him. He knew that standing there in front of him, this promise fulfilled, was the very sacrifice that God had asked. And yet he says, God will provide. God will provide. And so they walked on together. You know, when it comes to that dark place in our life and in that journey, that's what it comes down to sometimes, doesn't it? We even repeat words that in that moment we might even say, I'm not sure I believe them, but we keep going. God will provide. I wonder if even as he said those words in his head, he was saying to himself, yeah, right. You see, that's what happens on this road to God-forsakenness. We begin to doubt even what we know to be true, but by faith we walk on. And the writer just keeps peeling away the layers of this drama, one piece at a time. He gives no more than life itself gives. This is the now, the moment we live in. This is where obedience takes place. It's active, not passive. It doesn't happen in the future, in the not there yet that we talked about. And it's too late for obedience in the past, because that chapter's already been written and closed. It's only in the now that we get to experience what it means to live by faith. I don't know if that's ever a thought about that. But as Christians, as we walk day by day in faith, this is the now for us. This is the only place that we really get to experience what it means to walk by faith. It can't be in the future, because the future isn't there yet. And it certainly can't be in the past. We can reminisce over times we have walked by faith and seen God work, but the moment that we live in is the now, and it's where we experience. We know what it means to say God himself will provide. And so Abraham takes his son, his only son, who he loves, and he ties him up. That very same son he held at birth and named Isaac, laughter. That same son who he rocked to sleep and told stories to, who was his future, his destiny, his hope, his promise. The only one who was the covenant of God. And he lays him on the altar. And now the road is very, very dark. And then he raises his hand towards heaven, and he prepares with one thrust of his knife to destroy that life that he created, to destroy his dream, his promise, his hope, his joy, his laughter. Now we have to stop here for a moment in the story, because I know we have a tendency to want to run on, to hurry on to the happy ending. As a matter of fact, even when we teach Sunday school, we don't deal with the in-between, do we? We go right to the end, to that place where God provides, because that's the place where we see the solution, God's promise fulfilled. But we need to linger, because the truth is that's where we live, in that interim place, in the now, because it is in the now that obedience takes place. We, like Abraham, have learned what it's like to live in the land of Moriah and know that God himself will provide. That's where we learn that lesson. In the 3 days that the results came back from my tests, in those 3 days, I learned more about God than I had throughout my entire pastoral career, because I was experiencing it. I was living it in the now. I remember the night that after the surgery and we were waiting for results, the first night, we had to go to a birthday party for a friend. And it was, you know, one of those 60 years or whatever, and we were close friends, and so we went to the party. But my whole time that evening, my mind was in another place. I was in that dark place. I was saying, yes, I believe and I trust, but, you see, that's the now. That's where we learn to experience what it means to walk by faith. Here's what it's like. A couple, desperately want to start a family. They've prayed and they've waited and they've waited and they prayed for 12 long years and still nothing. They're exhausted every medical avenue and still they wait. They see others with baby carriages and wonder, why does God not bless us? And then one day, when they've all but given up hope, it happens and a new life is brought into the world. And then when he's 3 years old, this little boy, this real little boy, this answer to prayer develops a fever, and the doctors can't seem to find out what's wrong, and the word cancer is whispered and then echoed in the halls of the hospital. And then just as suddenly, they are alone again. And this mother and father, and now their answered prayer hurts far more than the unanswered prayer ever did. You see, this is the world you and I live in. This is the land of Moriah, the now. The land where people, real people, have hopes and dreams. Some good, some not so good. Some wise, some not so wise. Some good, some really good dreams. And sometimes faith means just hanging on. Maybe some of you here this morning are in that place. You have wonderful dreams. You had a wonderful dream about a marriage relationship. And now you're in that marriage, and there's been deep disappointment. You've prayed about it, and you've wept about it, and you've sought counseling, and you've tried everything you know how to try. And you long to know what it's like to walk hand in hand in a loving and joyous relationship. But short of a miracle, that's not going to be. And faith to you is just hanging on. But you refuse to walk away when it would be easy to walk away. You refuse to have an affair when it would be tempting to do just that. You refuse to dishonor God, and you refuse to play the martyr about it. So you respond with tenacious obedience, and you hang on. Perhaps you're single, and you're lonely, and you wonder, why hasn't God given you the gift of companionship in marriage? And you ache when you see other couples, but you refuse to enter into a relationship that would dishonor God. It just means hanging on, being tenaciously obedient, even when it's difficult. That's what it means to live by faith in the land of Moriah. And so Abraham raises his hands in the air, ready to destroy everything. But even in that moment, even as he prepares to bring the world to a crashing halt, he hopes and believes, not perfectly, but he believes in God, who, even though he seems not to care, would emerge the God who makes all things possible, who makes impossible promises and keeps them, and then names them laughter. And Abraham keeps hoping when, from a human perspective, it seems absurd. He doesn't have perfect faith. He just keeps hanging on. He just places himself in the hands of God. So, the faith that sees us through this darkness is also, thirdly, a faith that fears God. That's when it happens. God calls on Abraham again. Verse 11. He says, do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. He says, first of all, but the angel of the Lord, by the way, in the Old Testament, the angel of the Lord is actually a theophany, a God. That is actually God, the angel of the Lord. So God speaks to him, and he calls to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Here I am. I'm still available to you. I'm still willing to be obedient to you. Even through all of this darkness, even though I can't see what's going to happen, I'm still willing to trust you. Do not lay a hand on the boy, for now I know that you fear God. Fear here is not a fear, a cowering in fear, but rather a fear that recognizes with respect the ability to God to do what he promised to do. It's a fear that enabled God to hold back nothing from God, or enabled Abraham to hold back nothing from God, to put himself completely in God's hands, to hang on because the road got so dark he could do nothing else. To understand what it means to fear God is to travel down the road of God-forsakenness to that place that seems so dark, that there is no way out, that not only to reach out for the hand of God, but totally place our lives in his hands. It has come to that place where we don't just allow God to lead us, we ask him to carry us because we realize we're incapable of walking any further. It's difficult to explain what that looks like so often. Perhaps you can catch a sense of it from the words of a man who walked that road and learned to fear God. Learn what hanging on looks like for a person of faith. These are the words of a college president, a Christian college president by the name of McQuilkin, who traces the long, slow descent of his wife as she struggles with Alzheimer's. How she had to give up one thing after another. She had a radio ministry, had to give that up. She had she was involved in public speaking, that had to go. She was a writer, she had to give that up. She was a counselor, she had to quit that as well. He writes, Muriel didn't know what was happening to her. Although occasionally when she heard a reference to Alzheimer's on TV, she would muse aloud, I wonder if I will ever have that. It did not seem painful for her, but it was a slow dying for me to watch the vibrant, creative, articulate person I knew and loved gradually dimming out. Then he begins to write about the dark road, where he had to struggle between the rest of his life, his work, and so on, and the caring of Muriel. It was clear to him that in his case, God was calling him to care for his wife. It doesn't always mean that everyone needs to handle the situation in the same way, but for him, it was clear. Take care of her. He writes, she's such a delight to me. I don't have to care for her. I get to. One of the blessings and the things that she's teaching me so much about is love, for example, God's love. She picks flowers outside, anyone's flowers, and fills the house with them. Lately, she's been picking the flowers inside the house as well. Muriel cannot speak in sentences, only phrases and words which often don't make sense. No means yes, and yes means no, for example. But she can say one sentence, and she says it often, I love you. It's the one sentence she has left. She not only says it, she acts it. The board arranged a companion to stay at our house so I could go to the office daily. During these two years, it was increasingly difficult to keep Muriel at home. As soon as I would leave, she would take out after me. With me, she was content. Without me, she was distressed and sometimes terror-stricken. The walk to school is a mile round trip, and she would make that trip as many as 10 times a day. Sometimes at night, I would help her undress, and I found her feet bloody. When I told our family doctor, he choked up. Such love, he simply said. And then he added, I have a theory. The characteristics developed over the years come out at times like these. McQuilkin writes, I wish I loved God like that. Desperate to be near him at all times. Thus she teaches me day after day. Family and friends often ask, how are you doing? And they take that to mean, how do you feel? And I'm at a loss to respond. There is a subterranean grief that will not go away. This is the darkness. I just feel as alone as if I had never known her. But the loneliness of the nights comes because I did know her. Do I grieve her loss or mine? Further, there is the sorrow that comes from my increasing difficulty in meeting her needs. This, he writes, is part of living on that road to Moriah. Finally, there came a time when they had to decide his career or caring for his wife. And this is what he writes. When the time came for the decision, it was firm. It took no great calculation. It was a matter of integrity. I had promised 42 years ago in sickness and in health, till death do us part. This was no grim duty to me, to which I was stoically resigned. It was only fair. After all, she had cared for me with marvelous devotion for so many years. If I took care of her just 4 years, I would never be out of her debt. It is more to me than keeping promises and being fair, however. As I watch her brave descent into Bolivia, Muriel is the joy of my life. Daily I discern new manifestations of the kind of person she is, the wife I always loved. I also see fresh manifestations of God's love, the God I long to love more fully. His story is the story of Abraham and the story of every human being who has ever walked down that road of the valley of the shadow of death. And it's your story and my story, or it can be. Because if you are here this morning, yeah, and you've known, or maybe you know right now what it means to walk in that darkness, it may be a relationship in which you feel betrayed. It may be a task that has been given to you, which there's no glory, no visible reward. It may be a call to keep fighting against the same temptation that you fought over and over and over against so long that you just want to give up and walk away. It may be a call to be faithful to a promise that you've made, to a life sacrifice, to a level of sacrifice, to a level of giving that is just wearing you out. And you're pouring yourself into a ministry for people who don't deserve it and don't appreciate it. See, I don't know what it looks like for you. But I know this. Every human being that ever lived must walk in darkness at some time. But one day, that third day will come. And hear me well, friends. It came for Abraham. It came on the life of another who also stepped out on that road of God-forsakenness. The one who cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Like another son who had to carry on his back the wood upon which he would die. Only when it came time for his sacrifice, nobody came by to say, there's a thicket, and there's a ram in the bush. No one came by to save him, to stop him, and Jesus was killed. But the third day came for him too. And the third day will come for you and for me. Someday, friends, the third day will come, and blessed on that day will be everyone who stayed the road. Blessed on that day will be all who chose the path of tenacious obedience. Blessed is Abraham. Blessed are all who live by faith, who can say with Abraham, "Here I am, Lord. Here I am, Lord." So as you think about this story, about our phrase about being an alien, about not fearing, I want to leave this last phrase with you this morning. If you're traveling today through one of those dark places, I want you to think of this story and remember what Abraham said. Here I am. Say that with me. Here I am. It's a solemn phrase, isn't it? Thanks be to God that Jesus said, "Here I am, Lord." Let's pray. Father, thank you. Thank you for your goodness to us. Thank you for this man, Abraham. With all of his failures, he trusted you to the very end. He was obedient even in the darkest moments. He was willing to give up everything for you. God, help us in those dark days to just keep going, to say, "Here I am, Lord." In Jesus' name, amen.